It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get an inside look now on the recent ProPublica investigation that called attention to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas accepting trips and undisclosed gifts over the years from a Republican megadonor. Call in with questions and comments about these revelations, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Justin Elliott is a ProPublica reporter covering business and politics and worked on this probe. Justin, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Great to be here.
Well, starting with the vacations, what did ProPublica's investigation uncover in these trips taken by Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas?
Yeah, what we found is that a Texas real estate billionaire and political donor named Harlan Crow has been taking Justice Thomas on incredibly lavish vacations around the world, really, for more than 20 years. We're talking private jet flights, cruises on the businessman's super yacht around the world to places like Indonesia and New Zealand. Harlan Crow owns this this sort of lavish private resort in the Adirondacks. Clarence Thomas is there virtually every summer. So some of these trips, you know, we're talking hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars for a single trip. So just a lot of travel over many, many years.
Have you done some, you know, rough estimates how much Harlan Crow spent on the justices' vacations and travel over the 20 some years?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to come up with a specific number, but it's an enormous amount of money. I mean, to give you an example, I mean, I've personally never been on a private jet, but it turns out that Harlan Crow has a particularly nice private jet. It's a Bombardier Global 5000. And if you were to charter one of these on the open market, you'd be paying upwards of $15,000 per flight hour. So if you fly to Indonesia, as Harlan Crow did fly Justice Thomas, that's like a 25, 30-hour flight. So if you do the arithmetic there, the flight alone is like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars.
You know, this Dallas businessman with deep connections to Republicans, Harlan Crow, we hear words like the billionaire, a Republican megadonor. What has Crow done for the GOP? Can you give us a sketch?
Sure. So he's been a donor for many years to campaigns, both in Texas, where he lives, but also nationally, you know, well over $10 million over the years, probably tens of millions. But I think more relevant for this story is that he's also been very involved as a funder of ideological efforts, and specifically around the law and the courts. So he's given money to, for example, the Federalist Society, which is a well-known conservative legal organization. He's on the board of several think tanks that, among other issues, you know, do advocacy on legal matters and on the court. So he's had a long-time interest as a funder in the law. So, you know, it raises the question that we're still reporting on this, of what is the nature of his relationship with the Supreme Court justice? Is there some sort of influence here?
And Thomas's companions on these vacations, because it wasn't just like the two of them, what interests might they have before the court in the other people on some of these trips?
That's right. So we found, you know, it's very hard as a reporter to sort of get inside these trips, but we were able in a few cases to learn the identities of some of the other guests. And we're talking about corporate executives from companies like Verizon, other executives from some of these think tanks that are active on legal issues. And, you know, if we were talking about a member of Congress here, there's a whole system of lobbying disclosure where you can look up who's lobbying, how much money they're spending, what they're talking about. With the Supreme Court, it's just incredibly opaque. They don't really have to disclose anything. This has all sort of historically been a black box. But obviously, you know, the stakes when you're talking about potentially influencing a Supreme Court justice are just enormous. I mean, if you even got them to shift their thinking a little bit on a legal issue and that made its way into an opinion, that could just have huge consequences for really everyone.
talking about the ProPublica investigation of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas's relationship with billionaire Harlan Crow. And we have journalist Justin Elliott, who worked on this probe. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Lisa in Madison. Lisa, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. Actually, 2 points. Aside from the trips, it's my understanding that he also goes to Harlan Crow's, estate or whatever, out east, I believe, somewhere where a lot of these other people are also invited. And there's a painting of Thomas with some of these very wealthy people at this estate. But the other point that I wanted to bring up is Harlan Crow, I believe it was in the ProPublica piece, also is the individual who helped to put the video together where Justice Thomas talking about how he's your everyday man who prefers to go camping and can't, you know, go to the take his RV to the Walmart parking lots, which you juxtaposition this against these ultra expensive, vacations. I don't even really know what word to describe for what that implies.
Lisa, thanks for the call. Justin, can you give some clarity there?
Yeah, absolutely. So Lisa is correct. There's a whole series of sort of financial entanglements between Crow and Thomas. And one of the examples is Crow contributed several hundred thousand dollars to the production of this documentary about Clarence Thomas's life called Created Equal. And this was a documentary that actually aired on PBS, I believe, but it was made by a bunch of sort of friends and supporters of Clarence Thomas to present a very sort of friendly picture of his biography in response to coverage of things like the Anita Hill case. And just sort of, they were upset about negative press coverage essentially over the years. So Crow helped fund that. And in that documentary, Justice Thomas claims that he prefers sort of hanging out in Walmart parking lots and driving around the country in his RV to taking sort of fancy vacations to Europe. And while it is true that he does in fact own an RV and he does sometimes travel around the US, you know, before our story, he somehow failed to ever mention publicly that he is sort of regularly jetting around on private jets. He is, you know, on a super yacht and is, taking vacations that really only the very richest people in the country can afford.
What of all this has the justice put into disclosure documents?
Right. So that's the other big issue raised by our stories, which is it turns out Supreme Court justices, like many other federal officials, are required to disclose most gifts over a few hundred dollars. In this case, Justice Thomas didn't disclose any of these trips. We talked to a number of ethics lawyers who said that many of these trips, especially the ones involving private jet flights, absolutely should have been disclosed as gifts, and none of them were. So all of that seems to be just violations of this law that was passed actually after the Watergate scandal back in the 70s that requires disclosure of this kind of thing.
Let's bring in Jim in River Falls. Jim, what is your question?
Good morning. Thanks for the show. Yeah, I have heard, about congressional investigations or what Chief Justice Roberts could do, taking off, the chief writer for legal opinions and things like that. But can the American Bar Association have any effect on this? I mean, I know a lot of professional organizations, they could revoke somebody's license, like for doctors or veterinarians, things like that. Can I'm just wondering what the American Bar Association could do, if they could censure him or revoke his license, and what their impact might be.
Jim, thank you. Justin, how could a potential reprimand happen?
It's a great question, and I honestly don't know the answer to what the Bar Association could do. I mean, I think one of the larger issues that we've been getting out these stories is that Supreme Court justices, not just Justice Thomas, seem to be sort of operating and living in a atmosphere of something close to impunity. I mean, there's in the rest of the federal government, there's an entire infrastructure of ethics lawyers who, you know, make sure people are disclosing what they should be. And if they don't, there's potential enforcement. You know, people can get fired and that sort of thing. With the Supreme Court, it's a black box as to whether anything like that exists. It doesn't appear to exist. You know, we're still looking at all that. And one thing that has happened is that the Senate Judiciary Committee has announced that they're going to hold hearings related to all this. We don't know much detail about that yet, but certainly, at least in theory, Congress could, you know, do a lot to investigate all this.
Yeah, Senate Judiciary Chairman Dick Durbin, the Illinois Democrat, said that the Senate Judiciary Committee, quote, will act. ProPublica reporter Justin Elliott here explaining what his nonprofit newsroom discovered about Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Be part of this conversation. Call in with questions, comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine issues of disclosure and ethics in the Supreme Court. This following the ProPublica investigation on how Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas accepted lavish gifts from a billionaire businessman for over two decades. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. ProPublica reporter Justin Elliott worked on this story, covers business and politics. Justin, you've been reporting on how Harlan Crow also purchased property from Justice Thomas. What did you find there?
That's right. So, you know, for our first story, both Justice Thomas and Harlan Crow ended up putting out statements saying, like, look, we traveled together, but we're very close friends. These are family trips. After we published the first story, we found out and published a second story about actually a real estate deal between Crow and Thomas. So about a decade ago, Harlan Crow, through a company that he controls, actually purchased a house and two vacant lots down in Savannah, Georgia, that were part owned by Clarence Thomas. This transaction was also not disclosed, as it should have been, by Justice Thomas. Very unusual situation. The house that Harlan Crow bought from Thomas was a house that had been Thomas's childhood home that his elderly mother was living in and apparently still lives in. So not only was there this real estate transaction between the two of them, and we're not really sure whether he paid fair market value, but also Crow now appears to be in the extremely unusual situation of being the landlord to a Supreme Court justice's mother. Hmm. Although it's not clear the term landlord is actually the right one here, because it's not clear whether he's actually charging her rent.
Hmm. So what was the intention? Is there any understanding of why this property transaction happened?
Yeah, so Clarence Thomas has not commented on this yet. You know, we sent questions to him, as we always do for these stories. Mm-hmm. But Crow did put out a statement, and what he told us was that his intention is someday to create a museum in this building that was, again, where Clarence Thomas spent some of his childhood in Savannah. But he didn't answer a bunch of our questions. One of them was, you know, he also bought two vacant lots down the street from Thomas. So, you know, we asked the obvious question, why did you have to buy these vacant lots to create a museum in this house, sort of in a different part of the block? And he didn't answer that. And, you know, another aspect of this is, after he bought Thomas's mother's house, they did around $35,000 of improvements. They added a carport, they replaced the roof, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so, again, how that sort of fits with the stated goal of historical preservation of this building was never really addressed.
Still unclear. The Wall Street Journal editorial board critical of your reporting, says there's no evidence that Harlan Crow received anything corrupt in return from Justice Thomas for the vacations and the gifts. Why should people be concerned about free vacations that a Supreme Court justice has received?
Yeah. You know, it's true that at least at this stage of the reporting, there's no evidence that we've uncovered of like a direct quid pro quo where Harlan Crow has gotten something. Although I will say that we're still reporting, and if anyone out there has information about this, they should get in touch. But, you know, we've been thinking about this question of influence in a kind of broader way. Obviously, it would be quite interesting if there were some sort of exchange. But, you know, I've covered Congress for a long time. And when you look at the money that gets poured into lobbying in Congress, you know, lobbying works, but it's not usually a direct exchange of money for a vote. It's kind of a broader spectrum than that. You know, if you spend time with a public official with power, you can, you know, present certain ideas to them, present certain narratives to them, sort of shape the way they think. And if that process can sort of be lubricated by giving them gifts or campaign donations, or in the case of Clarence Thomas, taking him on fancy vacations, then that obviously is going to make the subject of that sort of lobbying more sympathetic to the views being presented. Now, we don't know what is happening between Crow and Thomas, and Crow has actually said that he is not trying to influence the justice. But you know, because all this is happening sort of on private jets and super yachts that are not open to the public, of course, we just don't know at this point what is being discussed. So you know, it's something we're still looking at.
We have ProPublica journalist Justin Elliott on the investigation of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas's relationship with billionaire Harlan Crow. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Lisa is here from Milwaukee. Lisa, what is your question?
Hello. I wanted to know, how long has he, the gentleman that is on the radio right now, how long have you been investigating? Is it Clarence Thomas or the other guy that you've been investigating?
Justice Thomas.
I was wondering, with the new world that we're having with the, equality for blacks, does it seem like you have a modern day kind of hanging for Clarence Thomas, you know, going after him? If you said in your speech that we haven't found anything yet, but we're still looking.
Justin, go ahead.
Yeah. With respect to the first question, my colleagues and I on this have been reporting on the Supreme Court basically since the beginning of this year, so 3 or 4 months. And actually, we're reporting on the entire court. These happen to be the first stories we published, but you know, I can't talk much about what we have coming. But I guess I can just say, stay tuned. We plan to have other stories on the court, not just about Clarence Thomas.
Do judges face looser restrictions around these things in members of Congress? I mean, Wisconsin just held the most expensive state Supreme Court race in U.S. history. Judicial ethics, a major theme of the campaign. Are the ethics guidelines for SCOTUS different from other federal judges or even state high court judges?
Yeah, they absolutely are different. So, you know, to broaden the lens, I mean, to other branches of government first, members of Congress, for example, they couldn't even accept many of the gifts we're talking about, like setting aside the question of disclosure. You know, I have friends that work in the federal government just as normal, you know, sort of mid-level or low-level folks. And they say, you know, we have to be careful about people even buying us lunch. And so Supreme Court justices and judges more generally, federal judges, have very few restrictions on the sort of gifts they can accept. There are some, but they're few. And the Supreme Court has fewer rules even than other federal judges. So, for example, federal judges below the Supreme Court have a code of conduct, like mm-hmm. a code of ethics that says what you sort of can and can't do. Mm-hmm. But that code explicitly does not apply to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court Essentially, the setup is that they are supposed to police themselves, and with matters of ethics, with matters of recusals, when there's potential conflict of interest in a case, whether they, you know, step away from that case. And there's been repeated controversies about this around recusals, not just with Justice Thomas, with a number of justices over the years. And so, you know, one of the things that's happened in the wake of the stories we've been doing is that there's been sort of renewed conversation in Congress about potentially tightening up the rules around all of that and bringing the Supreme Court more in line with other branches of government when it comes to these ethics rules.
Justin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Justin Elliott, reporter with ProPublica since 2012. Find a link to ProPublica's investigation at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We check in on the regional economy with insights from the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, the 7th Federal Reserve District. It covers most of Wisconsin and 4 other Midwestern states in our vicinity. Cullen, with your questions about the Chicago Fed and the economy of the upper Midwest, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tom Wallstrom is a senior business economist with the Chicago Fed. Tom, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good morning. Well, starting with inflation, the Bureau of Labor Statistics says Americans are paying roughly 5% higher prices now than they were a year ago. And the Bureau also says inflation is rising at a slower pace in recent months. How is it affecting our Midwest economy?
Sure. Yeah. And let me first say that I have to say a disclaimer here that these views are mine and not the views of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago or the Federal Reserve System. So you can't walk away from this conversation today thinking that anyone but Tom Wallstrom said these things. So I got to be careful to make sure that's clear.
Fair enough.
Inflation is definitely, it's a nationwide phenomenon and certainly a worldwide phenomenon, and many other places are dealing with high inflation right now. So it's certainly affecting the Midwest economy in Wisconsin, just like it's affecting everywhere else. But like you said, you know, it's high, but it's coming down. And part of the reason that it's coming down is because the economy is cooling. And part of the reason the economy is cooling is because the Fed has raised rates to help slow the economy.
But, you know, interest rates, they do keep rising, but more slowly now, of course, than last year. But why is it taking so long for inflation to subside?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. If we're going to talk about the effect of interest rates on inflation, that takes time. There's some parts of the economy that are really sensitive to interest rates and some that aren't. We've definitely seen slowing in the real estate sector. We've seen slowing growth in the manufacturing sector, which is particularly important for our district and for Wisconsin. But we haven't seen slowing in other sectors as much that are less sensitive to interest rates. So it takes time for interest rate policy to spread throughout the economy. And, you know, I think the other thing is that we've had a lot of some really strong headwinds that have been keeping demand quite solid, even as the economy has been slowing. We haven't seen a huge we've seen growth slow, but we haven't seen growth really go down really quickly. And if growth really took a hit like it did, during the pandemic, we definitely saw inflation drop quickly then, but we haven't seen growth slow that much, just enough to start taking the teeth out of the inflation. But that's kind of actually, I think what Fed policymakers generally are hoping for is we're hoping to land, to do this soft landing thing where we, the economy slows, but not to the point where it's really super painful to bring down inflation, but inflation still comes down.
I wonder about wage inflation, though, when your cost of labor goes up in response to these rising costs all around us at the grocery store and beyond. Do you see wage inflation as a concern here in the Midwest economy?
Yeah, so we've definitely seen wages going up quickly along with prices. They tend to move together. Generally, wage growth tends to lag inflation just a little bit, but it's definitely been a factor. And we've seen at least the wages that we're all, the numbers that we're all familiar with, the wages adjusted for inflation, definitely going up quickly. But when you actually take out the inflation, wage growth hasn't been super strong. Mm-hmm. So we would expect to see, I think, part of what's going on right now, and with a slowing economy, is we would expect to see the labor market cooling some. It has perhaps cooled a little bit, but if you look at the national data and also at the local, state and local data, you can see that the labor market's really strong everywhere. And I think the Fed decision makers, as well as many other forecasters, would say that we do have to, you know, the labor market's so strong right now that it might have to cool some in order for inflation, both on the wage side and the price side, to come down. But again, we're hoping that the cooling is not super painful, and that there's the unemployment rate's really low. It might have to come up some in order for inflation to slow down to where target is for the Fed, but hopefully not have to come up above its long run rate very high or for very long.
Well, let's get the Tom Wallstrom take on the potential for a recession. I mean, we saw your boss, Chicago Fed President Austin Goolsbee, saying, quote, a mild recession is a definite possibility for the American economy. What is a mild recession? What does that mean?
That's a great question. Yeah, and thank you for noting that we're getting the Tom Wallstrom take on this. I've been thinking about this too, and looking at the what does a mild recession mean? I think, you know, for sure a mild recession means nothing like what we saw with the pandemic or the Great Recession, for that matter. I've seen forecasts for unemployment. You know, so the long run, let me just say this first, the long run unemployment rate that the FOMC, the median FOMC participant sees, is about 4%. So 4% would be this is for the nation, 4% would be what's going on when the economy is neither too hot nor too cold. We're at about 3.5% unemployment right now. So there's this expectation that unemployment has to come up. And the hope is that it doesn't have to come up much more than 4%. Now, if unemployment came up to 4.5%, which is one forecast I've seen out there for ending the year at 4.5%, you know, at least in my book, I wouldn't call that a hard landing, or it might not even be called a recession. I'm also not in charge. Actually, Austin, the president, and I are not in charge of, in the end, deciding what a recession is. That's up to the National Bureau of, actually forgetting the acronym, it's the NBER. There are folks at the NBER that decide officially whether the economy has gone into recession. So I'm not going to try to read their minds and say when we're going to cross the threshold between recession and not recession. But if it got up to 4.5, to me, I would say that's maybe not even a recession. But I think a mild recession might be like 6% unemployment or something like that, where, you know, compare that to 13 or 14% that we saw with the pandemic. It wouldn't, you know, no one wants the unemployment rate to get up to 6%. But if it did, maybe that would be, we might call that a mild recession. Now, I think you also asked about what do I think the chances are? I don't know. I don't think anyone, I'm not allowed to make bets on these things anyway. So
you're supposed to say above my pay grade, right?
Yes, exactly. But I mean, it wouldn't surprise me, I guess, if we got up to 6%, but it also wouldn't surprise me if we stayed in the 4 to 4.5% range. I still think that's a possibility in what we're we're certainly hoping for.
Well, all I can offer on my end is unpacking NBER, National Bureau of Economic Research. We have
Tom, we go. Thank
Tom,
you.
Tom Wallstrom, Chicago Fed economist, as we take a more deeper dive into the Midwest economy and learn about its place in the broader context of America. You can join in. Questions, comments, 800-642-1234. Stevenson Prairie, hi, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So over the past 10 years, maybe not that long, but a number of years, there's been a lot of discussion, even on NPR, about wages and minimum wage and artificially increasing wages through different government programs. Didn't the guest just say that wages and inflation are tied together? So can the guest put to rest and just state as a fact, if the government artificially increases wages, that will cause inflation?
Steve, thanks. Tom, can you weigh in there?
That's a tough question. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to say a ton about that. I think maybe I can step back and say how I think about how wage growth generally works and how wages and inflation generally work together. And I don't know if this is going to answer the caller's question. But I think, you know, let's talk about wages first, wages adjusted for inflation, so real wages. In general, real wages should grow with the productivity of the labor force. So if we've come up with new technology or our labor force perhaps becomes more educated, workers find a way to be more productive in the same number of hours of working. And we would expect that to result in wage increases, real wage increases. And those are the wage increases we're really interested in, our real wage increases. I think that's what everyone would like to see. Now, there's also a connection between, as I mentioned, between wages and inflation. So if we have prices of everything going up, we should also see prices of we should also see wages going up as well, because wages are a price and they're an important price that also goes into the consumer prices in the end, because employers have to pay wages. So we should expect to see wages and inflation moving together. But not necessarily real wages, because real wages, of course, are wages adjusted for inflation, and those are going to be more related to the fundamental factors driving the economy. I think that's all I can say. I can't. I don't think I'd feel comfortable taking a strong stance. I don't think we can talk about facts exactly in terms of the relationship between what the government. I think it's harder to talk about facts in terms of particular sectors setting wages in particular ways. That's out of my wheelhouse, I guess I have to say. So,
senior business economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, Tom Wallstrom here, giving us a read into the economic conditions of Wisconsin and the upper Midwest. Bring on your questions, your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So what does the Chicago Fed know about our regional economy and where it's headed? Call in with your questions for Chicago Fed economist Tom Wallstrom. Number to join in about the upper Midwest economy, conditions of banks, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tom, let's talk about the health of banks, the two U.S. bank failures last month that was unsettling, rattled financial markets. What are the repercussions of the banking turmoil on the Midwest economy?
Great question. And thanks again for having me. And let me again repeat that these are my views and not the views of anyone else. You know, I think that when we're talking about the financial sector, it's really is a national phenomenon. So it's kind of hard to say, you know, interest rates are largely determined at the national level. So it's kind of hard to say that the effects are going to be that much different here in the Midwest than anywhere else. But, I think there's a couple things to say related to the bank failures that recently happened. First, you know, Fed leadership, and not just Fed leadership in the government, have stated that the U.S. financial system is stable and resilient. And, you know, that's I think that's fair to say. I think so far it appears that, you know, the steps taken by the Fed and other government agencies to stop the run on mid-sized banks seems to be working. But, you know, there's still a lot that we don't know, like you mentioned. It took, when we had the financial crisis in 2008, it took a while for it to become clear where the problems were. And I think there's still certainly concerns out there that there could be other problems that come up. But, you know, at this point, it doesn't look like that we're in a 2008 situation, especially because we're seeing from the bigger banks that are, you know, arguably more systemically important in a sense, because, and they've been subject to greater regulation as a result, though they seem to be fine at the moment. But, you know, I'm going to say seem, not they are, because, mm-hmm. you know, something else could come up. But, you know, there's an open question of how much has credit perhaps that's available to businesses to borrow and use to create growth, how much has that been pulled back? And I think at the moment we don't really know the answer, but it's definitely something Fed officials have been talking about in terms of, well, you know, to some extent, this might be the turmoil might be the equivalent of a rate increase or some number of rate increases. And I think that's another one we don't know. There's, because we're still waiting to get more information on how much this might be kind of the equivalent of a Fed rate increase. But at the moment, you know, I guess I'd still emphasize that by and large, it seems like we're not in a 2008 situation at this moment with the financial sector.
Naturally, though, here in the Midwest, you know, we thought about those mid-size Midwestern banks that, mm-hmm. you know, mid-size really fits that Midwest banking sector, because so much of that happens, you know, the big banks happen on the coast. So, you know, the financial stress tests that I would imagine takes place for these mid-size and smaller Midwestern banks.
That's a great question. I actually don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I'm in the research department. Our job is to just kind of keep track of the current state of the economy. Maybe
gotcha.
We're too siloed with the supervision and regulation folks that are on top of this stuff. But yeah, that's...
Well, here's one for you. You took away the Midwest Economy Index that measured regional business growth for more than 40 years. That went away in the pandemic, 2021, in that time frame. So what now is your best gauge of the regional economy?
Great. So let me tell you that one casualty of one additional casualty of the pandemic was our Midwest Economy Index. The changes were so huge in terms and so quick and bouncy, I guess is not a great word, but there were things were so volatile that the way we calculate that index ended up not really being sustainable after the pandemic. So, you know, but that doesn't mean we don't have ways of keeping track of what's going on. Underlying that index was actually, it was a big collection of employment data. I think those are the data that, in my opinion, are the best data for keeping track of state economies. So this would be the jobs numbers at the state level. So, you know, I'm guessing many of your listeners are familiar with the national jobs numbers mm-hmm. that come out the first Friday of every month. We have to wait a couple more weeks to get 2.5 more weeks to get state and local employment numbers. And those are the ones I really pay attention to. I like those the best because they're the most broad based and they come out in a pretty timely manner relative to the reference period. I pay less attention to the unemployment rate numbers, which are from a much smaller sample size. This index was actually built on those jobs numbers. So you can just go look at the regular jobs numbers yourselves. There were some nice insights we could get out of that index when it was actually working. But we're not able to publish that anymore. The other thing that I'll point you to is we actually have a survey mm-hmm. that is it's like a quick and quick take survey where we have about 120 people in our district that fill this out, and they're their business representatives and nonprofit leaders. And that survey we field right around the same time as the job survey is fielded, but we turn it around a lot quicker because we don't have as much processing to do. So that's called the Chicago Fed Survey of Economic Conditions. And I think when we had the Midwest Economy Index, the two surveys tracked each other pretty closely. And so that's another one I pay attention to, partly because I produce it, but also because I think it is a good indicator of the 7th District. And I want to say one more thing before you cut me off, is that actually this is an opportunity for your listeners perhaps to talk to us. So, you know, we do a lot of looking at hard data, you could call it, numbers, but we also gather data qualitatively. And one of the ways we do that is through this Chicago Fed Survey of Economic Conditions. We're actually always looking for people who want to talk to us and tell us what they're seeing, because this survey is not required by law that businesses fill it out. It's something that people do as their civic duty to help us keep track of the Midwest economy. So I'd welcome anyone to go visit our site for that survey and let us know if they want to talk to us.
Oh, I'm going to cut you off now as I reintroduce you, Tom Wahlstrom, an economist with the Chicago Fed. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You know, what you're saying there and trying to read sentiment from how people are doing and that perceptions of how we're doing in life, they're increasingly important sources of data, especially for the work that you do. There is sentiment out there that mainstream economists are out of touch with how Americans are really, really doing. And I'm wondering, what is your take on that criticism?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's always fair to say that economists, whether at the Federal Reserve System or anywhere else, could do a better job of thinking about how the economy is affecting people and how it's directly affecting people's lives. And I think that's actually a big part of why we do some of our outreach efforts, such as doing this survey. We also do roundtables where we talk to people. And again, we're always interested in trying to hear from people about how they feel about the economy. We don't have unlimited resources to talk to every single person, but it's definitely something we're interested in hearing about. And I think, no one's going to wants to pretend that we don't have blind spots, that we don't have ways that we could learn more and do better. And I think that's just a fundamental part of doing research in the first place, is being curious about what you know about the world and what you don't know about the world, and trying to get a better handle on what's actually happening out there.
Tom, thank you for joining us and giving us a peek into your world.
Happy to do it. Thanks for all the great questions.
Tom Wahlstrom is an economist with the Chicago Fed. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.